Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience, and have a fantastic day. Are you approaching retirement, or maybe you've just changed jobs? If so, you'll probably now have control of your 401k or IRA. Would you like to buy some property, notes, loans, start a new business, or even buy crypto? You can with a self-directed IRA. For more than a decade, I've been telling you about setting up a self-directed IRA through IRA Advantage. And while you may now hear other companies say they offer self-directed IRAs, you need to find out if they're truly self-directed. With a truly self-directed retirement account, you can make any investment the law allows. Whether you're talking about true diversification, starting your new business, or investing in private holdings, IRA Advantage through a truly self-directed IRA can make that happen. Take it from me, Lars. You've worked hard for your money. IRA Advantage will work hard to keep it yours.
Would you like to learn more about truly self-directed IRAs? Then visit IRAAdvantage.com. View our videos and call IRA Advantage. That's IRAAdvantage.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Wednesday on Honestly Provocative Talk Radio. It is the Radio Northwest Network proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 and a half years. And we got a lot to talk about today. In fact, the sheet kept filling up and filling up. It is unbelievable how much there is to talk about. And I want to invite you to that conversation. If you want to sound off, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, you go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. They all come directly to me, nobody else. You can also vote in our Twitter poll, and I'll tell you about that in just a moment. But I know that right now, at this point in the year, an awful lot of parents are seeing their kids do the last days of their school year, depending on the school schedule where you live. Oregon, of course, has one of the shortest, if not the shortest, school years in America. Washington isn't much better. You're watching the kids do the last few days of this school year, and if they're young enough, if they didn't graduate this year, you're thinking, where are they going to go to school this fall? And I think a lot of parents are asking that question more and more, not just assuming, well, they'll go back to the same government-run, failing public school they attended this year. You may be thinking, I need to find another alternative. I need to take my child to a charter school, which is a public school but is run entirely differently than the union-dominated government-run public schools. Charter schools are independent. You can also have private school. You can have parochial school. You can have online school, whatever fits your kids the best. And one of these days, we may get to the point where the dollars will follow the children wherever the children and their parents want to take their educational desires. You can do that in junior college. You can do that in college. You can't do that in K through 12 public schools in most parts of America, and certainly not here in the Pacific Northwest. In fact, the teachers' unions have done everything they possibly can to limit charter schools. In Washington state, they're limited by law. There are limits on online charter schools in Oregon. They've done everything they can because they realize that when they lose the monopoly on your kids, they lose the dollars, and that's what they care about most. But let me bring something new into the picture. An awful lot of parents during the pandemic were more than a little bit shocked to find out the kind of garbage that was being shoveled into their kids' heads on a daily basis. They were finding out that the kids were being talked about critical race theory, about changing their gender from male to female or female to male. They were being told all kinds of crazy ideas. And the parents finally said, look, can you stop all this? Just teach our kids how to read, write, count, do math, some social studies, maybe some science. Do that really well. Forget about the sex. Forget about the transgender. Forget about teaching little white kids that they're evil because they're part of the dominant class, and little brown and black kids that they're oppressed in some way. Stop doing that. But I want to throw something brand new into it, and I'll cite the reporting of Fox News this week. They discovered that there is a program that schools, it's the biggest program used literally worldwide in K through 12 schools. And what it does is it tracks library books. You know, it's a library book management system. It's called Destiny. And they discovered that Destiny allows the schools to track the books. It even allows the kids to find, I'm looking for a book about this, or I'm looking for a book about that. But it's mostly unavailable to citizens, taxpayers, and most importantly to parents. Well, they began to find out that if you could look at this program, and they did, you find out that some of the schools, including schools here in the Pacific Northwest, are putting pornographic books in front of kids. Now, I know you're saying, well, Lars, you're just exaggerating this. Fox News Digital literally said they had screenshots of the inappropriate titles and the books on gender ideology and some of the pictures in the books, and parents are fit to be tied. They're saying, you can't put this kind of stuff in front of my children. They list this Destiny program, lists books in at least three high schools in Oregon, Milwaukee, Adrian C. Nelson, and Clackamas High School. And one of the books was written about by a college student at Duke University who said, this book is too much even for me in college. It's called Fun Home. It contains images of lesbian sex and masturbation and other images like that. Images so raw that Fox News wouldn't even put them on the air. So if they're too raw for a mostly adult audience of news watchers, are they too raw for kids in elementary and middle and high school? And the second question that I want you to consider, because this goes into your decision about, do my kids go back to the failing government schools, the ones where a third of the kids drop out, and of the two-thirds that remains behind, about half of them make the minimum marks to be considered adequately educated, and the other half fail to make the minimum marks? That kind of failure? I mean, it's a failure you can describe in actual measurable terms. The second question is, should all taxpayers have access to know what is being put into school libraries and what is being taken out? I think that's reasonable. Now, I had my producer, Donovan Sargent, check the Destiny program not readily available to the public. The schools use the program and they keep it locked up so parents, taxpayers, and the general public have no access to it. The parents only have access if the schools allow them access, which at this point is not likely to happen because you know what happened during the pandemic when a lot of parents started watching the online lessons and even teachers. I remember one teacher was on video saying, we can't let the parents see what we're teaching their kids in classrooms. They'll be angry about it. Well, I would suggest a rule for anybody who's in the teaching profession. I am not. But if you're in the teaching profession and you're about to teach kids something that would piss off their parents if their parents knew what you were teaching them, that's probably the moment where you say, maybe if this would make their parents angry to have me teaching their kids this stuff, maybe I shouldn't be teaching it to them at all. And I want to tell you that conservative attitudes, listen, I don't want politics in classrooms. And you all remember the fight that we followed all of last year and into this year. In Newburgh Public Schools, you had a school board that said, why don't we just have the kids taught what they're supposed to be taught, keep the politics out of the classroom. They voted by a majority to make that the rule in the Newburgh schools. And then the community said, well, we'll recall you. And the recall failed. In other words, the community supported the idea, kicked the politics out of the classrooms. Well, guess what? The folks on the losing side of that vote, the vote where they wanted to keep politics in the classroom, those two board members just quit. They resigned because they said, we can't stand it here. Why? Because you can't push your progressive liberal agenda on little kids in public schools where they're required by law to go to that school, so they're a captive audience, and where the dollars don't make the parents and the kids free to go to another school. You don't want to be part of that because you can't push your political agenda. Then, as far as I'm concerned, to those two resigning school board members in Newburgh, good riddance, good luck. But in the meantime, we don't need you making decisions for kids where you want to push your politics on them. That's just dead wrong. It is a Wednesday. It's my pleasure to be with you. In a moment, the Northwest nonsense and one major Northwest city talks about trying out a new form of government, and it is a disaster. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
Brought to you by Handyman Maintenance Remodeling. You can find them at hmrservices.net. That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
You know, some days I may be really dumb, but I'm not dumb enough to ever argue that Portland has a great city government. It failed miserably, especially in the last 2 years, as mobs in the streets demanded defunding of police and City Hall went along, and that led to a massive increase in crime. Now, a charter review commission has come up with a complicated and expensive reform of that bad government that guarantees a lot more politics, but no more effective government. Voters, thankfully, have to approve it first. That may happen this fall. And 7 times in the last 100 years in Portland, they've said no. No matter how bad the system is now, we don't like your reform. The plan would obesify the city council from 5 members to 12. Remember, all those new politicians will need offices and staff and funding. The mayor gets more power, but he also gets money to hire a city administrator who will then actually do the mayor's job for him. He gets staff and offices too, by the way. Can you smell the stink of a future demand for a brand new and bigger city hall to contain all these new politicians? Oh, and then there's ranked choice voting. It takes Portland from 2 city council elections to just 1, and those in charge get to change your votes to decide a winner if need be. Anybody like that system? So we go from a small bad government to a much bigger bad government with no guarantee that anything actually changes. And now, today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Rogue Conveyors. Go Rogue.
You know, I keep hearing from Joe Biden and from politicians, there are so many people in America who need help, which means they need money. And I say, why don't they go get a job? There are millions of jobs available. In fact, throughout America, there are 2 jobs available for every 1 person who might like a job. So that labor shortage has left pools in Oregon and beaches without lifeguards. Summer right here. I mean, it's arriving in about a week. There's a shortage of lifeguards in Portland. The Aquatics Department needs 750 lifeguards. They say they have to rebuild their staff from scratch. So far, they've got only 42%. If somebody failed that badly as a manager in the private sector, they'd get their walking papers. But in this case, I'm sure they'll just get a raise and more money to spend. But it seems pretty pathetic to leave all those kids without summertime pools and lifeguards on the beaches. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Mobile Joe's RV Collision. Get back on the open road and back to your adventures with Mobile Joe's. No body damage, too big or small. Collision or paint repairs, Mobile Joe's RV Collision fixes them all. Kevin Sterrett of the Oregon Firearms Federation says, Lars, I was listening to your podcast last night with former House Speaker from the Oregon House of Representatives, Mark Simmons. It was weird listening to him talk about fines. First of all, I don't know if there was ever any way for them to collect the fines that they threatened against Republicans who would walk out and deny a quorum. It may not have even been legal. But more importantly, the House rules that allowed the fines to be levied were voted on by the House members. So every single Republican House member knew what was in the rules. If they stayed on the floor for that vote, they tacitly agreed to it because they knew the Democrats have the votes to pass anything. So to hear Republicans whine about fines they agreed to is comical. Signed, Kevin Sterrett. I want to mention one other thing. There are now programs ginning up to have you surrender your guns to a local law enforcement agency. He says, by the way, the Oregon Firearms Federation has a similar program, and actually OFF is pro-Second Amendment. An awful lot of city police agencies are not. Now, on that note, I want to bring on Kristen. Kristen, you just happened to be listening and heard me mention that story that involves you directly as the mother of a child who is going to be subject to pornography.
Yes, I spoke on Fox News this morning about how there is 187 sexual inappropriate books in our school district's libraries for North Clackamas School District.
What do you think of that as a mom?
It's disgusting. truly disgusting. And what's even more disgusting is we did a FOIA request, which is a public disclosure, to the board. And they just replied this week that they don't know when the books got into our libraries. They don't know who purchased and paid for them. And they're basically denying any record, even though their entire system, which is Destiny, is in a completely online catalog. So they should have record of all of that, but they're basically trying to deny it.
Is the school board doing what you want them to do by saying we shouldn't put this kind of material in front of kids?
They are denying it. They are not answering us on a FOIA request, and they are not acknowledging that they have that material. And as a school board, it is their fiduciary duty to uphold the laws, and they are breaking state and federal laws by exposing our children to pornographic material. And it is our responsibility as parents that we have rights as parents, U.S. federal rights, that we are able to obtain the material that our children are exposed to as a parent. They have to release that information to us by federal law.
Because people might say, well, you should keep an eye on the books your daughter brings home, but she might see these books in the library and know I'm never going to bring these home, but she might still be exposed to that. That sounds like abuse of a child, putting pornographic material in front of a child. I know there's a charge in the law for that. Maybe your next call ought to be to the district attorney, because DA could subpoena all those records and say to the school, if you're putting this stuff in front of kids, you may actually be breaking the law. I don't know if they are or not, but it's at least a question worth asking of somebody like the current DA.
Well, absolutely. And to be honest, they are state mandatory reporters of child abuse. And if there is that content that our children are exposed to in the schools, then they need to report it to police and to the sheriff's office.
What do you think the real agenda is here, Kristen? Why would any adult want to put this in front of kids?
If you want me to be really honest with you,
there is
a narrative and there is an agenda that they want to shame our children of their race. They want to strip our children of their identity. They want to confuse them of the gender, and they want to expose our children to sexual content so they can groom them and they can indoctrinate them. And so they can basically own our children. That is where the heart of this is. And if anybody doesn't wake up and pull their children out of every single public school across the U.S., they are ignorant and they have their head in their sand. And next thing they know, they will look at their children and they will realize that they no longer have any control. And they've basically handed their child over to the government.
Kristen, I'm really glad you were listening. I'm glad you decided to call in. And I'm glad I told you to be really, really honest, because I love that honest answer. And I think you're right on target. Thanks for the time.
Yeah, thank you.
You bet. That's Kristen, who's a mom. She was featured on Fox News. She just happened to be listening as I mentioned this story. Your kids are having pornographic material put in front of them. The school districts have a way to track what's being put in the library, and they're keeping it a secret from most parents in most of the school districts around the Northwest. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. Always a pleasure. And I'll get to your calls in just a moment. I don't want to miss out on a great naysayer, but it's always a pleasure to welcome the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter from Willamette Week, Mr. Nigel Jaquess. And Nigel, I understand, has made his debut on the big screen, but this is going to be a serious subject to talk about. Nigel, welcome back. And how is it that you made your way into moving pictures?
Well, a friend of mine from journalism school who lives in Portland has made a bunch of documentaries. And back in July of 2020, she sent me an email. We were all working in our basement at that time and said, hey, let's meet for virtual coffee. There's a hell of a local story I'd love to get your help on. And it was the story, the Boy Scouts had recently gone bankrupt nationally. And a big reason for that bankruptcy was a 2010 court case here that was decided by another old friend of yours, Kelly Clark. In that case, a victim sued the Boy Scouts and won a settlement of nearly $20 million. But more importantly, what happened in that case was that the Boy Scouts were forced for the first time ever to put into the public record part of the secret files that they had been keeping since the 1920s, which detailed pedophiles within the Boy Scout organization. And so when the Boy Scouts went bankrupt, we knew there was a story, and my colleague Irene Taylor had run into a woman who all day long her job is to take phone calls from former Boy Scouts who were sexually abused, and we thought that was a good starting point for a story.
No, it is a great starting point. Does this one does this sound an awful lot like or echo what happened with the Catholic Church, where they knew there was a problem and they didn't or wouldn't or couldn't act to stop the problem, so they decided if we can't do that, we'll cover it up?
Many, many similarities. I think, one important difference is that the Boy Scouts are even more sort of deeply woven into the fabric of American society, perhaps, than the Catholic Church. No offense to the Catholic Church, but the Boy Scouts are in, pretty much every community in this country, and they are pretty much, Eagle Scouts and other men who have been Boy Scouts are CEOs, they're leaders of universities, they're leaders of arts organizations, they're in the media, they're literally everywhere. There have been more than 100 million boys have been Boy Scouts, and most of them are still alive today. So, the scope of the organization, and, let's face it, you and I have both used the expression, that guy's a real Boy Scout. I mean, it's a term that means integrity. The words Boy Scout mean integrity. They talk about service. And so it's just kind of an astonishing situation.
Yeah, that they ended up, because it's very clear that the organization covered it up. And I guess, look, I was a Boy Scout at one point. I was a Weeblos. I was a Cub Scout. I did all of those things. Never made it to Eagle Scout. But the thing that troubles me about this, Nigel, is I see organizations like this that run into these, this problem. They say, well, we've got a scout leader and we need to get rid of him. Why? Well, because he's doing things he shouldn't be doing with the kids, maybe even criminal things. Well, I don't know that the Boy Scouts are covered under the mandatory reporter law, but even still, you should do the right thing. The problem is and tell me if I'm not right about this. The problem is, legally, if you say we're firing you from the Boy Scouts, either as a paid person within the organization or as a volunteer because you're a pervert, that if that gets public, the organization gets sued. If you don't do anything, the organization gets sued. If you try to block certain people from taking part in the organization, you get sued. And it almost seems as though, I'm not making excuses, Warren, I'm just saying, in some cases, you have almost no option that gives you an option to do the right thing and still survive it. Am I wrong? Do you think I'm wrong about that?
Well, here's the problem. It's complicated, of course, but through 1991, the Boy Scouts had an explicit policy that said we will not tell law enforcement, we will not tell members of the community, we will not tell the employer of the scout official. These are volunteer scout officials, they have day jobs. We will not tell anybody. And so I think that was an enormous problem. And you're right, you run some risk when you take action. But if they had just simply, in many cases, reported to law enforcement, said, look, we've got information here, we're not cops, could you do an investigation and find out if there's been a crime committed here? But in many, 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 many cases, they simply just told the guy to move on. And what we learned is that in many cases, those guys who moved on to another troop because, they want to be where the boys are, and Boy Scouts are where the boys are.
Yeah, and I've had prosecutors, including my friend Josh Marquis, who's said to me, while there are a lot of worthy people that are attracted to jobs in the Boy Scouts or jobs as gymnastics coaches or whatever, the problem is a lot of the perverts, the ones that want to go out and commit sexual crimes against children, also gravitate to those jobs because, as you said, that's where the boys are. I'm also aware, though, as an employer, if somebody calls me up and says, what kind of employee was that person? Well, I could probably, you know, I'm full of opinions. On the other hand, the smart thing to do is to say, that person worked here from this date to that date, and that's about it. Because if I say anything more, unless it's entirely positive, then I get sued. And everybody who's an employer knows that. And the Boy Scouts they're not employers of all of those people. The volunteers, I think, are not considered employees. But if you call the cops and say, hey, we think this guy was doing things that were illegal against children, sexual crimes, and then it turns out it's not upheld, or the police look and they say, we don't see enough there, and then the person sues you and says you've defamed me, they're probably going to win. And so I think it gives them a tough set of options. So, but you're right. If they had done the right thing from the get-go, and certainly not have a policy, especially when you're supposed to be loyal, trustworthy, and all that, that you don't say, and we're not going to talk to the cops when we know things are going wrong.
Yeah, I mean, look, the setup was perfect for pedophiles because you're taking kids into the woods, you're taking them swimming, you've got them in tents which have no security, they don't have cell phones, also, you're talking about adolescent boys who want merit badges. They want to advance in rank. They want the approval of the scoutmaster. And in many cases, families are bringing their sons to the Boy Scouts because there's a broken home or the parents are too busy, don't have enough time for the kids. So you have incredibly vulnerable kids who are essentially just ripe for the picking, and they want the approval of that scoutmaster. They want those merit badges. They want to advance. It has been a very, very easy situation for pedophiles to exploit.
So the documentary called Leave No Trace, which is the name of it, and that, of course, for those of us in Boy Scouts who recognize that phrase, it debuted, what, about 10 days ago at the Tribeca Film Festival? What kind of reaction did it get? Do you know?
Well, this is not an uplifting film, but it got a rave review from the Wall Street Journal's critic, who was a notoriously tough critic, and the audience was, I would say, moved. You know, they weren't. You're not. It's not the kind of movie that leaves you cheering and clapping. But the audience, I think, responded and got what we were trying to convey, which is, you know, ultimately we want parents to think very, very hard about even the most respectable organizations. Are you putting your child in a place that is safe or dangerous? And how can you avoid having happen what happened to to tens of thousands of Boy Scouts? So yeah, and it can be seen. Just to plug the movie, it debuts nationally tomorrow on the streaming platform Hulu. So I hope people will watch it, and I hope they'll think about how we can all help kids be safer.
And real quick, for your involvement, does this mean you get to add an Oscar to your Pulitzer?
Highly unlikely. I am on screen much more than I thought I would ever be. In fact, I didn't expect to be on screen at all. I thought I'd be doing what I usually do, which is, find public records and do some interviews. But, Lars, you and I know I have a face made for radio. So,
as do I. Nigel Jaquist from W Week.
In the hole again, Joe Biden's got us in the hole again, the market's lower than when Sleepy Joe got in, and Biden's got us in the hole again, in the red again, Joe Biden's put us in the red again, the Trump recovery he ruined with his pen, and we're all stuck in Biden's hole again. In the hole again, every day it seems the stock market is falling, out of control again, the economy Joe stuck us with is stalling, it's galling, got to vote.
Welcome
again.
Back to the Lars Larson Show. That's our great parody guy, Mr. Jim Gossett, and this is Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network. I always like to start with a naysayer, and we endeavor to do so when we can. Joanna, welcome to the program, and what do you and I disagree about today?
Hi, Lars. I have been listening to your talks about the public schools, and I disagree about the quality of all the public schools in Oregon and Washington because my kids go to the sister schools, and I have nothing but great things to say about the school district.
Okay. How many of the kids drop out before they finish? What percentage?
That I don't know.
Okay. Statewide, it's about 25 to 30%. And of the ones who stay behind, the other two-thirds, about half of them make the minimum marks and about half of them do not. And during the pandemic, Kate Brown signed a bill, a law, that says you can get a graduation diploma even if you can't read, write, or do math. Now, does that sound like a successful school system to you?
Well, overall, but I'm just saying that, there's pockets that are still successful and they do a great job with the kids. And I think that sister schools, a lot of the kids graduate and go on to great programs.
I'm just curious.
Newspaper reports it all the time.
Because, Joanna, Everywhere else in life, people have a batting average of one kind or another. The stock market is one batting average. Somebody's income is another batting average. You ask people, so how are you doing? You say, oh, sales are up. I guess I'm just wondering, are you assuming that the schools do a good job with the kids in Sisters alone? That's a small school district. I understand that. My cousin lives down there. But do you know how they do overall? Because if you've got a good batting average, do you generally at least brag, you know, you might brag on it a little bit and say, hey, 98% of our kids graduate and many of them go on to college. Do you ever hear any of those things from the local schools?
Right. I don't have the batting average, so to speak, for the school. However, my kids are younger, and I've been very involved in the classrooms. My daughter has special needs, and, I mean, we were open when a lot of schools were closed during COVID. That's the decision that our schools made. Our school still has the Pledge of Allegiance. So there are things that our school's doing, and I think that they invite community involvement. So we are frequently invited to speak with the superintendent and the principals and come to the schools. So I think that the sign that they want community involvement just speaks to the school itself and that they're in line with what the parents want. So I don't know how to fix the rest of the school, but I can tell you what the sister schools are doing.
I agree with you. Because, Joanna, when the schools refuse to talk about things, we call the schools all the time, and we routinely get a no. If we say, hey, we understand you're stocking pornography in the library according to this Destiny system that tracks all the books in school libraries nationwide, actually internationally, and they say, we won't talk about it. Well, what about critical race? No, we won't talk about any of that. And that does, so you're right. If you're in a district where they actually talk to the parents, they're open about what they're doing, and they produce a good result, it just might be interesting if you ask the I'll bet the superintendent of your district or the principal of your school knows his graduation percentages and probably even the percentage of kids who go on to other successful things. But, Joanna, I appreciate a good naysayer. Thank you.
Okay, I just wanted to recognize the teachers out here and all the hard work that they do. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Joanna, thanks very much. Let's go to Rhonda. Rhonda, you're one of the parents who alerted Fox News to the kinds of pictures and images and books that are being put in front of kids in the Clackamas School District?
Yes, I was actually at that school board meeting that your caller, a few callers ago, the mom who was interviewed by Fox was at. And when I heard about these books being in our libraries, you know, I kind of thought, well, how bad could they be? You know, I'm not a prude, but when I saw the pictures in those books, I was shocked. I can guarantee, like at the school board meeting, there's people who talked about, well, kids need books to identify with who are in the LGBT community. And I don't disagree with that. However, let's keep it rated G. I don't know why it needs to be so explicit. I actually emailed you on May 13th and May 16th with the photo.
And I got those.
And you did? Yeah, it's bad. And those include the ones that Fox News wouldn't air or show in their article. It's bad. And again, like I said, I'm not saying not to have books that the LGBT community can identify with. It just doesn't need to be rated R or rated X. There was an individual in there that said, you know, the kids are going to be able to see these types of pictures on their cell phones anyways, right? And yep. I don't understand that
argument.
Because if that's the case, you know, oh, okay, well, they can get a hold of drugs outside of school, too. Should we just go ahead and provide those for them, too? I don't like that logic.
No, I don't like that logic either. Rhonda, thanks so much for the call. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to get your calls, too. If you want to jump in to the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our Twitter poll. We put up a brand new poll question every day from the news of the day. Today, do public schools have the right to show your kids pornography? I'd say no to that. Apparently, some of the folks who were running the Clackamas School District feel differently about it because they've got porn in their library and parents want to know about that. Our Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Stan Pulliam joins me now. Mayor of Sandy, Oregon, one-time candidate for Oregon governor, seeking the Republican nomination. Didn't get it, but that's okay. He doesn't have sour grapes, do you, Stan?
Absolutely not. You can't have sour grapes, especially when the stakes are so high, Lars.
Absolutely. So the other day I heard from Bridget Barton, who also sought the GOP nomination, also did not get it. And she said, I want to make an endorsement on your show. I said, okay, fine. She came on. She endorsed Betsy Johnson. I immediately got a raft of emails from people saying, well, Lars, I'm disappointed in you. I said, I haven't endorsed anybody. I mean, I did in the primary, but I haven't endorsed anybody. And I admit it's going to be an interesting choice. I mean, the Tina Kotek choice is easy. She'd just be more of Kate Brown and worse. And so then you're left with the Republican candidate. And Stan, you know that I wasn't that crazy about the Republican candidate, but thankfully I don't vote in Oregon, but I'll still give people my opinion when I'm ready to give it. I have not taken a position just yet, but you have an endorsement today. Is that right?
Well, yeah, I do, Lars. And as you mentioned, you know, I was one of those candidates that ran for the Republican nomination. So, you know, I have opinions about the folks that ran and what I wanted to see in the outcome. But, you know, here's the deal. As people remember, your listeners will, I got into this race and this movement as mayor of my hometown. When I looked folks, small business owners in the eyes, when they were in the fight for their lives, for their livelihoods, their businesses. You may remember me talking about having two little girls in our public schools, some of the worst schools in this country. And with the red wave, the dynamics we have in front of us, Betsy Johnson in this race, giving Republicans, it may really be once-in-a-lifetime opportunity at the governorship. Lars, I got to tell you, we talk about whether we should be excited or not. I'm incredibly excited to endorse Christine Drazen to be our next Republican governor here in the state of Oregon. You know what, Lars? I'm 40 years old. I'm a political junkie. I've listened to you since the beginning of somebody growing up here. I can't think of a time since you've been on the radio since we've had a Republican governor in this state. It's time. It's time to unite. It's time to make it happen.
Yeah, I agree with you there, Stan. I just, you know, you understand my reservations about Drazen. However, having said that, I had Betsy Johnson on a couple of weeks ago and pretty well beat her up on her change in her Second Amendment position, which had always been relatively solid and now appears to be not all that solid at all. And I've got a problem with her position on the right to life because she doesn't take the right position on the right to life. Drazen does. But I guess what happened, I get frustrated because I just tell people, here's what I'm going to tell you about these candidates. This is my opinion, or these are the facts that we know. And it frustrates me a little bit because I guess there are people out there who say, well, if it's a Republican, you have to support it, you know, whatever the candidate is. And I say, you mean like Mitch McConnell, who just sold us out on guns yesterday, or Murkowski, or Collins, or Mitt Romney, for God's sake? You know, not everybody with an R in front of their name is fantastic. They have their flaws as well. And I want people to recognize those because that's the only way to hold them responsible. Because once they get in office, if Oregon gets its first Republican governor in 30 years, 30 plus years, more than a third of a century, I'd say that's going to be a great thing. But you have to remind them the go along, get along, let's compromise nonsense that we see in Olympia and in not so much in Salem, because they don't have to compromise the Republicans. The Democrats have super majorities in both houses, and they've been used to a Democrat governor. So their attitude about cooperation is less. But when I see people who go along with the Democrats on this, that, or the other thing and just say, well, we have to go along and get along, I don't like that at all.
Well, and I agree with you, Lars, and I don't like it at all either, right? And that's why I ran for governor. But the fact is those inter-party, you know, battles and stuff, the time to litigate those issues for me are in the past. And I know once we have a Republican governor, we have you to hold those folks accountable. That's going to happen. But you mentioned some really important issues there. You mentioned life. We only got one pro-life candidate in this race. True. You talked about the gun rights, Second Amendment. We only have one candidate that has not backed down on the Second Amendment. We can get into the walking out or whatever, but Betsy didn't walk out either. And we saw how Betsy reacted over the last couple of weeks, you know, when it really hit the fan on gun rights and standing up for our Second Amendment rights. Those are huge issues. You think about cap and trade, you know, and where Christine was on that issue.
And the cat
tax. You think
about
the gross receipts tax and the cat tax. I mean, listen, I hear you. I like an aggressive tone in our governor. I like conservative leadership. But here's the choice. Do you want Glenn Youngkin or do you want Joe Manchin as our next governor? And that's easy. I'll take Glenn Youngkin every day of the week.
So will I. And I'll tell you, in some ways, Johnson has done the Republicans a favor because when she first jumped in, I think she's not even officially on the ballot yet, although I think that's more of a formality to get the signatures. But I told people, I said, you know, if she's going to pull votes from somebody, I think she's going to pull more from the Democrats than she does from the Republicans. And how have the polls split? You've probably seen more than I have, Stan. But it seems it's a 30-30 race, you know, maybe 31-29, with Tina Kotek in second place. For Democrats in Oregon, that's a new thing for them. And why is it 30-30? Because 20 points get sucked up by Betsy Johnson's independent campaign, and I suspect that most of those 20 points came off Tina Kotek and not off Christine Drazen. So I think that that works in the favor of Republicans as well.
Well, that's right, Lars. And you go back to the 40 years. And then let's roll it back year and a half. The lockdowns, the shutdowns, the masks, the riots, the crime. I mean, we've seen the stakes. We've seen the desperation. We've seen what's on the line. This isn't time. You know, my feelings are hurt. This has been a really rough couple of weeks in my life. But you know what I think about? I think about my kids. I think about Lucy and Olivia. I think about my mom and dad, Tony and Sue, who own a small business, or my brother Kyle, who's going to take that business over next. Lars, those are the stakes of this election. That's why my hurt feelings don't matter. The state matters. The people I've met as I travel the state over the past year is what matters. We need to come together as conservatives and get excited about the opportunity we have in front of us.
No, I look at that way as well. And I hope that Washington State, where I cast my ballots, I hope we can end up with a Republican. Anybody who's happy with Jay Inslee, do you know that jackass, Mr. Climate Change? He literally sent out a campaign letter warning of blackouts and brownouts and power shortages, and then turned around when the legislature, his own legislature in Olympia, unanimously voted on a bill to make sure that the state was on top of keeping the power grid solid. I mean, how often do you get a unanimous verdict from the legislature, and he vetoed the bill? That is Stan Pulliam, former candidate for Oregon governor, mayor of Sandy, Oregon. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. Send me emails, talk@LarsLarson.com, and yes, they do all come directly to me. You can also vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find that two different places. I'm not crazy about Twitter, and I know that many of you are not as well, so we put it on Twitter. It's been there for years, and we also put it up on my website at LarsLarson.com. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 and a half years. I want you to think about something, and I want you to think about all of the various, I guess, movements you'd call them in American society. Several years ago, there was a movement, and it wasn't necessarily badly founded, called hashtag Me Too. And what they said was that powerful people would take sexual advantage of women, and in some cases of men, and that these powerful people got away with it. Now, I wondered about that when I saw a story that I'm going to tell you about in just a moment, because this occasion happens in a public school. And it's kind of the opposite of what was featured in hashtag Me Too, where somebody was accurately described as being a sexual predator and then got away with it because of his or her powerful position. Most of it was men, although I think a few women were accused of doing bad things as well. And in the public schools these days, just in the last couple of years, but this has really been going on for a long time, the schools and the union-led teachers in them actually encourage walkouts by students. And I can prove this because there have even been several cases where the schools would say, we didn't do this. The kids just came up with the idea on their own. They were inspired by something inside of them to walk out over climate change or teacher pay or racial justice or, you know, violent assaults, things like that. And then we would come to find out that there were actually text messages and emails that proved that the school district had actually encouraged the kids to do this because, you know, in most cases, teachers will tell you they're far short of the time they need to actually teach the kids the things they need to learn to be able to actually earn a high school diploma and go on to success in life. So if you're short of time, why would you ever want to tell kids to walk out for any reason whatsoever? But I want you to ask yourself this, because we're in a different environment now. when Trump was president, one of the things, I know some of you don't like Trump, but listen to this for a moment. Title IX has been abused by liberal Democrats. And here's one of the abuses they engage in, mostly at the college levels. They say if a young man, and in almost all cases, this is young men, if a young man is accused of sexual misdeeds against a fellow student, we will have a kangaroo court. We will not hear from the young man. He will not be represented by counsel. He will not get a chance to confront his accusers. He will not be, you know, all the other things that are promised to somebody accused of something by a government institution that you are required to be able to get because the Constitution requires that your God-given rights be respected, right? And the colleges would do this. They'd say, there's a young man accused of rape, let's say, and I know of some specific cases we covered on the show, and the local DA has looked at the case and found not enough evidence to even bring the charges and put it in front of a court or a jury. So we will try him instead without all that proof beyond a reasonable doubt and innocence presumed till proved guilty. Oh, we'll just throw all that out the window and we'll convict him if we feel like it. This isn't that bad, but it happened in Bellevue School District near Seattle at Newport High School. And a young man and his family have actually filed a lawsuit. He says he stayed silent up till now, but he can't take it anymore. He's a 17-year-old boy, teenager, and he and his ex-girlfriend, they broke up. They ended their relationship last fall. And right after that, the young lady vandalized his car and then physically hit him. Now, I'm sure it's not the first time that an ex-boyfriend has been hit by an ex-girlfriend, but it's not right. You know, she hits him, even if it's a girl hitting a guy, ain't right. But then his ex-girlfriend accused him of physically and emotionally assaulting her, whatever emotional assault is. But if he physically assaulted her, that's wrong. Now, the school officials, they didn't do much about it. And there was even a student walkout, again, over this. The police looked into it. They found not enough evidence at all to bring any kind of charges. So you'd say, okay, great, he's cleared. The problem is, he said there was a student walkout at the high school in November by his classmates who were upset by the assault allegations, the accusations against him. And he says the school just stood by and let this happen. He said he's remained quiet till now because he agreed with the district not to talk publicly about the matter, not to post about it on social media, and he has no contact with his ex-girlfriend. He says, I've followed the rules. He has followed the rules and the agreement. Nothing has changed. He's being harassed at school. He's being called names. They said he was a piece of blank, and they said that he was engaging in dating violence. Now, do you think that with school districts to say, we have to act? If a kid is being bullied, they should act. I agree. If a kid is being teased or called names, they should act. Okay, fine. That's how you maintain some discipline in the public schools. And what the parents say is, all we want is a discussion about the false accusations, understanding that people are innocent till proved guilty. He was never charged with a crime. The police investigated. They found nothing. And yet the school is just basically letting him twist in the wind as his fellow students, you know, go after him for this kind of thing. In other words, it sounds to me, I have to worry every day, and I don't worry a lot, but because I think I'm good at what I do, but I have to worry every day about making sure defamation does not come on this show. Somebody calls in and wants to badmouth somebody. If it's a public figure like Joe Biden or Donald Trump, you can do that all day long, and for the most part, get away with it. If you defame a private person, that can mean huge trouble. What the schools are effectively allowing to happen and not acting by their inaction, they're allowing all these rumors to continue. They're allowing this kid to be harassed, this kid to be called names for something he didn't do. Right? Now, I think it's incumbent on the schools to act in a case like this. And of course, we don't know the student's name. We're not putting it in there. And I'm not putting in the name of the young lady that he's accusing either. I just want to know what you think as parents about what happens when you hear almost every day that the schools say we have to get after bullying. What kind of bullying could be worse than having students in a school decide, apparently in numbers sufficient enough to be able to stage a walkout from the school because they believe that this young man should be punished for something he apparently didn't do. And when I say he apparently didn't do it, I mean, I don't know this family. I have no idea who they are. I've never met them to my knowledge. I mean, I don't know who they are. I don't recognize their name or anything else. Why in the world would the schools allow this kid to twist in the wind like this? I think this is just as bad as all the bullying that schools say, we're going to get after that. We're going to make sure nobody's bullied because of their orientation or their transgender status or the way they dress or the way they speak or anything else. Good. Make sure that happens. How about this kid? Falsely accused, he is wearing one of the worst scarlet letters that anyone in American society can wear as an adult or as a teenager, and he's having to deal with it at age 17, and he says the schools are doing nothing. It is their job to act in this case, and he's finally said, I've got to go public. We've got to file a lawsuit. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment. I want to ask Dr. Joel Zinberg about something, though. He's a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. It's about Medicaid. And I guess, Dr. Zinberg, it seems, welcome to the show, by the way, but it seems stunning that one American in four is now on government-funded welfare medicine, which was really designed to aid the poor. We're one of the most prosperous countries on earth. How can that be?
Well, it can be because, number one, Obamacare greatly expanded the number of people enrolled in Medicaid through the Medicaid expansion. And number two, in the last 2 years of the pandemic, largely because of some new government laws related to the pandemic, you had a 25% jump in the Medicare enrollment. About 15.9 million people were added to the Medicaid rolls.
And by the way, in the years immediately preceding the pandemic, with the big jump in employment, with virtually every sector, you know, hitting record low unemployment levels, you know, young Americans, old Americans, black Americans, white Americans, gay, straight, you know, Hispanic, black, every category went to record low levels in 18 and 19. The number dropped dramatically. And then as soon as the pandemic arrived, it jumped by 16 million. In some ways, I understand that because when we saw these massive layoffs of people across the country in the first few months of the pandemic, you had to have some place to go for your, you know, medical insurance. So the government said, okay, we'll do this during the emergency. But what is Joe Biden doing right now with that emergency?
Well, so, you know, you're absolutely correct that enrollments actually declined a little bit in 2018 and 2019. But when the pandemic started, a public health emergency was declared at the end of January 2020. And then a statute in March of 2020 imposed what was called a continuous enrollment condition, where they encouraged states to enroll people by increasing the amount that the federal government would pay towards total Medicaid costs. They pay what's called FMAP, which is the percentage of total Medicaid costs that the federal government paid. So they encouraged states to enroll people, and then they barred the states from redetermining eligibility, so they couldn't get rid of people who were ineligible. And that's really what CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, says is the cause of the big increase. It's not that people were suddenly out of a job and needed insurance. It's because they have this new statute. And now the Biden administration is proposing, it seems poised to anyway, extend the public health emergency, which is going to extend the those statutory provisions I just talked about. They're going to extend it for another 90 days. From the current middle of July expiration date to an expiration date in October.
And then, of course, in October, I'm sure they'll run ads saying if you elect Republicans, they're going to throw grandma off a cliff like they used to do in the ads against Paul Ryan. Let me ask you something. I know sometimes we use terms of art and complicated language. When you say ineligibility, Doc, you mean that if somebody was put on Medicaid because they lost their job during the pandemic, then in March of 20, they said, well, tell you what, even if you become ineligible, and I would think the clearest way to become ineligible would be you went back to work and your employer gave you health insurance. And they said, yeah, even if the person has a job, has the income and has health insurance, we're going to continue them on Medicaid. Is that sort of the short version
of that?
You're
exactly right. That's the problem. You know, states routinely do redeterminations because they want to see if people's circumstances have changed. And now states are not allowed to do that until the public health emergency ends. And the Biden administration doesn't really seem terribly perturbed by that. They seem like they're anxious just to preserve the government takeover of health care through this massive expansion of Medicaid, even if it covers a lot of people who aren't eligible.
Does this strike you that this is a way for them to move in the direction of national universal health care, what they call universal or single payer health care, where the government funds all health care and they basically drive everybody else out of the marketplace? Because employers who used to get offer, you know, and still do in many cases, offer very good health care benefits, they say, I don't need to offer health care. The government covers that. And oh, by the way, they've raised my taxes to pay for it. So why would I bother as a private employer to even offer it? You can have the bad drive out the good in that case, can't you?
Well, you know, you're in a situation now where the Urban Institute, which is not a conservative organization, just the reverse, the left of center organization, they are estimating that if the health emergency ends as scheduled in mid-July, there were 14.4 million people who are ineligible and would have to be cut from the Medicaid rolls. And by extending it to October, the Biden administration will increase that number by 1.4 million up to 15.8 million people. And if they extend it, you know, for additional, you know, 90-day periods, the number will continue to grow to the point where you're going to have people saying, hey, you can't, you know, throw all these people off of health insurance. It's terrible. They'll lose your insurance. They already have a number of public health organizations that are saying just those things. And the reality is, you know, that's not a justification for extending the thing that they're ineligible people. But this is what they're doing. They're trying to, I think, set up the condition where there will be so many people who will lose health insurance over the, you know, in the year after the emergency ends, that there'll be this backlash and they'll say, oh, gee, we ought to extend these relaxed conditions.
And maybe even make them permanent. I'm talking to Dr. Joel Zinberg from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Here's the question that occurs to me, and you may not have the number, but I think this number would tell the tale. If you're saying, well, if you cut it in mid-July, you'll have 15 million people who won't have Medicaid. It doesn't mean they don't have health insurance, because how many of those people are truly ineligible? They either make too much money, which means they should be on some other health insurance, or they have it through their employer. Do we even know how many of the people who might get thrown off? Is it half of them who already have alternate health insurance? Because they'll cast it to the public as, you're going to throw all these people out of health insurance and you'll have people dying. Well, what if half of them or a quarter of them or whatever the number is already have health insurance? They are ineligible, but the federal government has literally told the states, don't find out if they're ineligible, so we can call them all Medicaid dependent, even though many of them may not be.
Yeah, well, the best estimates are that almost all of these people will be the people who we're talking would be cut when the emergency ends would be eligible for employer provided insurance or for subsidized plans.
Almost
on
all
the
of them.
Obamacare Medicaid exchange.
Doc, that's insane. That I mean, to say, well, we're going to cut all these people because I can just see the campaign ads. You know, the Republicans want to throw 15 million people out of health insurance. Well, will they already have another health insurance to go to that's not run by the federal government? Yeah, but forget that. Just make, you know, we want to have you know, ads with grandmas being thrown off a cliff in a wheelchair.
Right. Well, they do not want people to have access to any sort of privately provided insurance. It's got to be, you know, funded and run by the government. And that seems to be the preference that they're pushing for, and that seems to be what's motivating this extension. I mean, look, any sort of objective measure, the health emergency is ended. You know, the cases are way down. Cases, you know, they bumped a little, but they're still way down compared to earlier points in the pandemic. Hospitalizations didn't rise to that percentage. They're still relatively low. And COVID deaths have been declining for months. They've never gone up in the last few months. Moreover, we've got vaccines and therapeutics available now that we never had before.
That's right. Dr. Joel Zinberg with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Doc, it's always a pleasure. Back in just a moment. Your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday, and it's the best conversation in talk journalism. You can join me right here, right now, at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our Twitter poll today, and we try to come up with a brand new question each and every day out of the news of the day, so it's fresh. Do the public schools have the right to show your kids pornography? And if you say, Lars, you're just exaggerating that, no. We're basing this on Fox News actually covered the story as well, but there's a program that tracks computer tracks all of the books in public schools K through 12, not just in the United States, but around the world. And the schools use that system so they know what do they have in inventory, what have they added recently, what have they taken out recently. It's called Destiny. And what parents have been doing when they can get access to it, because in most cases, parents and citizens are locked out of this indexing system. Now, I understand being locked out of student records and, you know, otherwise private material, but could anybody, even a really good naysayer to the show, tell me why there's a reason to lock out the citizens who pay for the government-run schools from a list of the books you stock in the library, the books you've removed from the library, and the books you've recently added? Do the public schools have the right to show your kids pornography? Some of the books feature not just descriptions of pedophile behavior, that is, adults seeking sexual activity with children, but they also include pictures. And they say some of the pictures are so raw, they can't even show them on television. I would say, no, the public schools do not have a right to show your kids pornography. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, I know we've talked a lot about schools, but I'll tell you what, the things that are going on right now are so crazy. I want to point something out to you. Statistically, when you worry about a mass shooting, especially worry about it affecting your family and your kids at their school, and you say, well, where do most of those mass shootings happen? They happen in gun-free zones. Now, you know that most of America is not a gun-free zone. I mean, in most of America, you can carry a gun, you can walk around with a gun, you can carry one concealed, depending on the state, with just the Constitution or even with a permit. The board of the Portland Public Schools voted last night to expand its weapons ban to restrict any individuals, even those with a concealed carry permit, from carrying a gun on public school property. I warned you that this was coming because a bill was passed earlier this year, Senate Bill 554, that gives the schools the ability to prohibit concealed carry on school property. Now, I know that some of you who don't care about this issue might say, well, what's the big deal? Here's the big deal. Number one, most mass shootings, 94% of them, happen in gun-free zones. This bill allows every district to do what Portland Public Schools did last night and vote to say nobody can carry a gun on school property. Now, if you're one of those people who's so dim that you say, well, that'll keep all the bad guys. They'll look at the rules and say, the rules say I can't carry a gun here, so I won't bring a gun to school. None of those rules stopped what happened in Uvalde, Texas. None of those rules stopped what happened at Thurston High in Springfield, Oregon, 20 years ago. None of those rules stopped the Columbine killers. None of them. The bad guys, by definition, don't follow the rules. But here's what will happen. You have just turned every single school district, if it wants to vote as Portland did, some districts have decided not to, into a gun-free zone. Now, are school shootings more common or less common? They actually statistically are less common. But when they happen, they are so devastating. I understand why they grab an enormous amount of public attention. So do you want to turn your schools into gun-free zones? There are schools in places like Texas and Missouri and other states where they actually allow the teachers to be armed. That's actually possible in Oregon. Any school district that wanted to let teachers carry a pistol could do it legally. or they could go the opposite direction and turn the school into a gun-free zone, which it makes the kids more at risk. They've done exactly that. But the second effect, and I want you to understand this, because even if you don't have a carry permit, even if you don't carry a gun, consider, do you want to turn hundreds of thousands of people into potential criminals? And here's how you'd become a criminal. When they pass these bans, you can't carry a gun anywhere on Portland public school property. That means on a Sunday afternoon, you take your dog for a walk and you go down to the local schoolyard to walk your dog around. If the police stopped you and said, they wondered what you were doing, can you identify yourself? And they ran you in their records. They say, you have a carry permit. Are you carrying today? If you're standing on school property, you have just committed a felony crime. And you may be going to jail. You may be prosecuted. You may be punished. And especially in liberal places like Multnomah County, where the prosecutor will go after conservatives all day long and twice on Sunday. That's all it takes. If you need to pick your kids up from school, if you need to drop them off at school, if you're a parent who believes that you want to carry a gun and you've got the permit in your wallet because Oregon requires a permit and so does Washington, you can't do it. You will be on school property and you will become a criminal. Now, that's not going to stop any criminals like the criminal in Uvalde, Texas. What it will do is turn a lot of honest, law-abiding citizens into criminals, and that's not a good thing. Pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday, 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. I got to tell you something. There was a story that jumped right out at me this morning. Because you'll remember there was a terrible mass shooting in Buffalo, New York, not long ago. The man shot, or is accused of shooting, 10 people to death in Buffalo in a supermarket. Now, what the news was not, well, has he been charged with a crime? That happened a long time ago. He has now been hit with federal hate crimes charges and firearms offenses. Now, I think he should be hit with the federal firearms offenses. In fact, I think prosecutors use that far they don't use it most of the time. They don't go after those extra charges. But the federal hate crimes charges really jumped out at me. And let me tell you why. I have always said that hate crimes should not be on the books at all. Now, that's not because I want people to commit hate crimes. It's because the existence of a hate crime actually suggests to people that some of us have greater rights than others. And under the American Constitution, all of us are entitled to equal protection under the law. That is, if you murder somebody, you commit the worst crime you could imagine, murdering somebody, that if you murder somebody who's important, it's a murder. If they're, average Joe, it's a murder. If they're high income, it's the same murder as if they're working at minimum wage or even unemployed. It is the same crime no matter who you are, except that in the last 20 years or so, we've heard this hue and cry saying, well, you have to start having hate crimes. Why? And what seems almost comical for such a serious situation as this is that this accused killer in Buffalo, he murdered people. Are you telling me that if he murdered a black person, that that is a greater crime than if he murdered a white person? And that's effectively what hate crimes do. And it really takes the entire idea of American criminal justice and stands it on its head. I mean, this country has certainly had its problems over the years. And I'm well aware that people who are prominent tend to get special treatment. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. That you have special treatment under the law. But putting it in case of a hate crime, saying we've already charged this guy with 10 homicides, but if we prosecute him and we get, say, 10 life sentences, we've got to add on to the top of that whatever extra penalties he gets because he murdered a person of color. Josh Marquis joins me now, former district attorney. Josh, good to have you back on. Just tell my audience, I don't like the idea of hate crimes at all. I think the very idea takes the idea of equal protection under the law and just throws it out the window. Would you agree?
Absolutely. First off, because a fundamental concept of American law, dating back to John Adams, is every person is equal under the law. There are some people, this is not Animal Farm, some people are not more equal than others. But on a very practical level, as you pointed out, Lars, a hate crime per se can never be more serious than the crime itself. So if you have something truly horrific like the Buffalo shootings, which appear to be premeditated murders, and the motivation makes it even worse, but nonetheless, it's aggravated murder. You can't get more serious than that. So when you say it's a hate crime, there's no possibility of making the penalty any greater. You can't do that. You can't punish someone more because of their motivation. And what's really ironic is I think that guy, if convicted, should get the death penalty. But the previous governor of New York, Mr. Cuomo, made darn sure, without the voters getting to vote on it, that the death penalty is no longer available for a crime as horrific as the Buffalo shooting. So what good does it do to say, oh, we're going to convict you of a hate crime, but on the other hand, we're just going to have you do a very long time out for the murders?
And yet this, the idea that people wanted to put hate crimes on, you know, on the books as a separate crime, I don't hear too many people objecting on the grounds on which I object, which is it creates two classes of people in the United States. And the very idea of our criminal justice system is we have one kind of justice. Now, we're all aware that when O.J. Simpson was put on trial for murder, his case was treated differently. I'm sure that when Paul Pelosi gets his treatment for his drunk driving arrest, he'll probably get different treatment because he's wealthy and he's politically connected. I don't know that we can do much of anything about that except saying our goal is that we make sure everybody's treated equally.
Equal treatment under the law. It says it. It's engraved on the Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C.
No.
And the other thing, of course, is what may be the group that that the elites want to protect today, just spin the clock back 70 years. In the 1950s, black people were the people who were not protected by the law. And people who had commie viewpoints and were professors were routinely fired, and actors couldn't get jobs. You never want to put people's rights up for a general vote. It's a dangerous thing to do.
No, it is. And it also could lead to some really bizarre results. In this case, in the case of Buffalo, I believe that every single one of the 10 who died in that case was a person of color, was a black person, a black citizen. But you could literally have an incident, and we do have incidents from time to time, in which not all of the victims are people of color. And would you literally walk into court and say, this man deserves punishment, you know, but he deserves extra punishment for these five victims and just the regular punishment for these? Because that's a kind of hypocrisy that undercuts the entire justice system, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it gets back to the idea that all lives are invaluable. All lives are equal. A rich man is no more valuable than a poor man. There is even a Supreme Court case from 1991 that talks about how it is improper for a defense attorney to claim that the murder victim was a no-account, mentally retarded, do-nothing, and therefore the jury should look at his death as less, not say a member of the community who was well-known.
Yeah, and so you can't diminish the victim because of their status in society, because of their capabilities, because of their income,
of their wealth, or their education,
or their wealth, or who they know. But on the other hand, you can't enhance somebody's importance and say, well
it would be exactly the same thing. I mean, the argument by the other side will be to say that, with some truth, that these are generally, characteristically marginalized groups who have in the past, sometimes in the distant past, not been given their fair shake. So, and I guess this is the very definition of equity over equality. So equity means we're going to impose unfairness and prejudice, almost as onerous as the ones we accuse people of, because that's the way to get even.
Absolutely. That's Josh Markey, former DA. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. It is the Radio Northwest Network serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. I want to take this call first. Rob Reynolds is on, Republican candidate for District 41. Rob, you're telling my producers that you were at the Portland Public School Board meeting when they adopted the no concealed carry at schools rule?
That's correct, Lars. I was allowed to speak for 3 minutes, and I just asked some poignant questions. The first one was I checked their website, and they don't have an active shooter policy on their website for the parents. And I says, well, you know, I'm representing three schools in my district and one daycare. So when people ask me, you know, your stance and what you're doing, I need to have some answers. And that was one of the questions I had for him is, you know, why is there not an active shooter policy? You know,
what'd they say?
And then I asked, you know, go ahead, sorry.
What'd they say?
They didn't respond. It was a statement only.
Okay. And then what'd you do?
There are two members that have their concealed carry permits. And the crazy thing and the good thing about it was one of the members, even though he voted yes on this, said that this policy would have no, would not affect anything for a crazy person that was going to shoot up the school. So and basically that, saying the policy.
Hold on. So that's a member of the Portland Public School Board who has a carry permit and says this will make no difference in terms of school security, but voted for it anyway.
Right.
Who was that?
You can, it's recorded. So you can go check out his statement.
Okay.
So it was close to the end of the meeting. We were there for, it's there at almost 10 o'clock last night. So, but yeah, he went off on how he had gone through his research and how he was going to come prepared to go vote against it. But then he talked to a few people and they talked him into voting for it.
But did anybody make a sensible, Rob, did anybody make a sensible argument as to how this makes kids safer?
No.
They just said we want to.
And the mothers against gun violence were there in force, but they, you know, the people that spoke for them didn't have a safety issue. They were just like, guns are bad, guns don't need to be on campus, they don't protect us. Then they were trying to use stats that say that guns don't stop violence.
See, because as of about next year, we'll be at 30 years of concealed carry being allowed in schools. And as I understand it, the numbers, the majority of schools have not taken advantage of this new law that allows them to outlaw it. Although the school district I went to in high school, Tillamook, decided to do it. And I couldn't figure that one out for the life of me or how anybody. And if it's not going to make people safer, I don't see any point in doing it. Rob, thanks for calling in. Gwen's on the line from Richland, listening in the Tri-Cities on KONA. Gwen, you're a librarian, is that right?
Hi, yes, I am. An LMS librarian.
You heard me talking about that Destiny system. They brag that they're the biggest online, book management system for K-12 schools, not just in America, but worldwide. Is that the case? Is that your experience?
Well, I work with Follett Destiny. So Follett Tidal Wave and Destiny is what we use. So I don't know how big they are, but I know that's what we use.
All right. Well, you heard me talking about this. Go ahead.
Oh, well, the reason I called was you had said, you had stated that parents cannot get on. They don't have access to these books to see what's in the catalog that's in the, it's in their libraries. And I just wanted to let you know that is a misconception.
Gwen, can I ask you, don't misquote me. I said, in most cases, the Destiny computer tracking system is not available to parents. I didn't say they couldn't go to the school and say, I'd like to walk into the school library and I'd like to look in the card catalog. So that's what you're saying. I said, I didn't say anything about the card catalog. I said about this tracking system.
You can get online and you can go into the Destiny computer program and you can see every book that I have in my library through the catalog search.
The company itself that provides Destiny says school districts often, and apparently a lot of them do, lock the parents out. You can be a student, you can be a teacher, but most other people are not allowed to access that system.
Well, I don't know of any district over here in the Tri-Cities that would do that. I know that now you don't have the same level of access that I have as a librarian, because you're not going to go in and be doing cataloging and weeding materials and doing curriculum. But if you want to find a book, you can search by keyword, you can search by title, you can search by author, you can search by subject or series, and you can go in and you can see, well, I have 16,000 books, you can see every single one of them.
Can you search the search? Go ahead.
Oh, they don't all, when you search for a book, so if a student is, and that's what I try to teach them, is how to find their own books. They all need to know how to access Destiny, how to put books on reserve if they want, how to put them on hold, how to find those books. And parents can go in and do that as well.
Now, just so we're clear, you're a school librarian, right?
Yeah, I'm a teacher librarian.
Are there any books in there that you would consider to have pornographic content?
Not in my library. But I will say this. I don't read every single book that's in that library because, like I said, I have 16,000 books. And
right.
So when a parent calls me and says, hey, the child brings this book back and says, my mom says this book is inappropriate, then I look at that book and I'll pull that and I'll take it out of the system. But you really need parents to flag those and let you know if the books are inappropriate. As a librarian, we use the Washington Children's Choice nominee books, and we use the Sasquatch books. And many times, I say probably every other year, the Washington Children's Choice books, which are the picture books that librarians read, and they use that as a curriculum for K-2.
Right.
Many times, there'll be one or two books in there that has a political agenda. And so you have to be really careful about that. So I don't ever add those. I make sure that those don't go in my library.
That's smart. And now, here's the thing. They're all the classic books that I'm sure you stock. How many new books does your library typically add in a year? Do you know? Like 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 or?
Oh, no, no, no. No, it's so expensive. But I probably add 100 to 200 books every year.
Do you think it should be part of the job of especially a school librarian to at least, you know, flip through all 100 of those and say, I've got a measure of what this book is. And then if you've got a concern, you go to your board and say, I don't think this book should be on the shelf, or maybe it's on the reserve shelf for adults only.
Well, I wouldn't go to the school board for something like that. You go to your principal and let them know that you're going to pull up that.
Well, see, but things run differently in the Tri-Cities, Gwen. The Tri-Cities are refreshingly conservative. At least that's my read on the Tri-Cities. I think that's why fewer problems in a conservative community, liberal communities, progressive communities, or regressive communities, a little bit different. Gwen, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. You're listening to Wednesday on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'll get back to your calls in the next segment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. Ever since Barack Obama became president of the United States for 8 long years, during which not much of anything happened except, of course, Obamacare and the Dream Act or Dream memo that he signed, it seems as though so many more things are about race. It's all about race. You hear about race virtually every day. So the question is, should colleges make race a factor defined in their rules, saying to teachers, you have to teach this stuff, diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. You must incorporate it in everything you do, every hiring decision, planning, program review, and everything you teach to students. I thought we'd ask Ethan Blevins about that, who's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. Ethan, welcome back to the program. And is this what California colleges are doing right now?
Thanks for having me. So, yes, the California Community College system has just recently adopted this regulation that requires all faculty to incorporate anti-racism into their curricula, into their program and practices, and it's now part of evaluation for promotion and tenure as well.
So that means if you don't go with a program, you're not getting tenure, you may not stay on the payroll, you may be sent down the road, and that's just been written into the rules, and that's the way it has to be.
That certainly is the way it's looking now. We'll see how it plays out, but I anticipate it may very well be worse in practice as the college districts adopt their own policies that implement this, which is probably going to be more explicit.
So is Pacific Legal Foundation going to take legal action against this? And do you have an opinion yet about whether this is legal and or constitutional?
We're certainly looking into it, and we are waiting a bit to see what the community college districts do, because one of the things the rule does is ask them to adopt their own local rules. But this is a minimum standard that faculty are expected to do this. I do think that it violates academic freedom, which is part of the First Amendment, your right to express yourself openly in the classroom, to deviate from your employer's viewpoint. That's especially important in the educational setting. And here it's going to be hard if you take a different view, for example, on the value of affirmative action or whether it's right to prefer certain minorities over other groups when doing college admissions, or how you feel about transgender athletics. All those issues are now subject to this orthodoxy that the college system is imposing on its faculty.
And they're going to tell faculty members, if we hear you start to step out of line, and I assume that's not just in the classroom giving a lecture, but maybe even on social media, that this is going to be incorporated into everything the colleges do?
Yes, I think so. And we have seen other colleges penalize faculty for speaking, even when it's not in their role as an educator. So it would not be surprising to see that kind of activity here.
Now, a lot of times attorneys, and I tell my audience this, you'll say, well, we have to wait until we actually have somebody who's been harmed by a policy. Do you have to wait until you get somebody who's been fired or a student who's been given a lower grade for not hewing to the DEI, I guess it's DEIA principles, or can you take action before that to prevent the damage from happening?
You can often take action beforehand. It's sometimes kind of an open question. There's a bit of a risk there that a court might say, hey, we don't know how they're going to enforce this yet. But, for example, just recently out of the University of Central Florida, there was a case where there was a challenge to similar rules. And the court said, you know, we're going to let this move forward. We don't have to find somebody who's been injured yet. Because one of the effects of this is that it chills the speech and viewpoints of academics now. They don't need to have this enforced against them to have that chilling effect where they're going to be afraid to express their viewpoint on certain issues. And that causes First Amendment injury without having to wait for enforcement.
Yeah, I'm glad. So the courts will or can act on that, because otherwise what you're effectively doing, isn't it, Ethan, you're saying to all these people who work in academics or a student, we need you to go far enough that they actually punish you by firing you, sending you down the road, putting a black mark on your academic record. And once you've been harmed that way, we'll step in and we'll get them to declare that it was wrong. But at that point, the injury's already occurred.
Right. You shouldn't have to risk your job in order to challenge something that I think is clearly unconstitutional. So there is some willingness for courts to look at this stuff, what we call pre-enforcement review, especially where a rule like this really imposes this sort of shadow over you, the sense that you're being watched and could be penalized just for expressing your viewpoint.
All right. So what would you tell, for people who are within systems that are starting to push DEIA, what's the best advice for them?
Keep
your head down and keep your mouth shut, or what?
No, I adamantly believe that we should be speaking out, because I think one of the problems here is that we do have kind of a silent majority. People are scared into speaking out. There's been a lot of research on this, especially with college students who in survey data regularly say they're afraid to say certain things that they would otherwise say. So we need to end that and be willing to speak up. Now, there may be consequences for that, but thankfully, organizations like Pacific Legal Foundation and others stand ready to assist when people are penalized for engaging in protected expression.
You know, I try to get people who push this DEI stuff to come on the program because I'd really like to ask them, how do you think this benefits the students or the employees or the system? Because I have to believe there are students out there and faculty members who are very good students, but if they keep silent and they don't say anything about what's going on to them, that they end up being to some extent damaged by this, even if they're excellent students. Because if you get great grades, did you get the great grades because of DEI, or did you get the great grades because you're actually smart and you did the work?
Well, you know, I think all college students, even outside this sort of orthodoxy, you know, when you're writing a paper or you're doing an exam, you naturally think, what does my teacher want to hear? And unfortunately, that's what occurs, especially in this system where certain viewpoints are going to be preferenced over others. And what we need is to provide students with a broad range of viewpoints. This doesn't just hurt the students who disagree with the DEI program. It hurts the people who agree with it but don't hear the other side.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you because even I've told people before, I read a great piece by a young lady who's now an entertainment lawyer, and she was one of Antonin Scalia's clerks. She was very fortunate, but she's very politically liberal. And she wrote this piece where she remembered working for the great Supreme Court justice before his passing. And he said, don't write what you think I want to hear. You know, she knew his politics. Write what the Constitution and the law says. And I wish every college professor had the guts to say to students, don't write a paper that's just buttering me up or trying to say what you think I'd like to have you hear. Say something that challenges me. Just make a good argument behind it. Except I don't know that there are a lot of college professors who have the guts to do that.
No, and they may face blowback from their administration if they encourage students to go against the grain. The question here is, are schools involved in education or indoctrination? And we need to persuade, not propagandize. And otherwise, we have a student body graduating who are unready to face the world and the tumult of varying opinions. And that's a shame for that coming generation.
Let me tell you, Ethan, they've already arrived in our workplaces, and it's sad. You know, we have to give them a safe space, a cup of cocoa, and maybe a warm blanket to get over it. That's Ethan Blevins, who's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. Back in a moment, I'll get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And by the way, this segment brought to you by Call 811. Whether it's in your yard or in the field, call 811 before you dig. I've done it myself. It is the law. Call 811 to know what's below or go to digsafelyoregon.com for details. Now, I want to share this with you. Steve wrote in, Lars, Biden keeps saying how he's going to fix these huge problems with all the tools of the federal government. What's in his toolbox? Chewing gum, scotch tape, and a rusty paperclip? FJB, thanks, Steve. And I couldn't agree with you more on that because this is the craziness we're up against. He's going to fix the problem of inflation created by government spending by having even more government spending. Yeah, there's a solution for you. Now to your calls. Let me go first to Tracy. Hey, Tracy, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Oh, hey, Lars. How are you doing today?
Very well.
Earlier you were talking about the Portland school board agreeing to adopt policies about gun control on their campuses.
Yep.
And I could not disagree with their decision any more than you myself, honestly. I'm a school board member here in Oregon, in Jefferson, and we are currently reviewing the policies that have been handed down for us to review and adopt, and I don't agree with the policies the way they're written.
Well, let me ask you something. Let me challenge you. How big's your school district? How many kids in the system?
We have anywhere between... Well, we're running right now in between 700 and 800 students.
Okay, it's a small one. But Tracy, yeah. It's legal under Oregon law if somebody has a carry permit to carry at school. Does your district allow teachers to carry a gun?
there is no policy that we have currently that allows them or does not allow them to.
So it's a don't ask, don't tell.
Let me back that up.
Okay.
We have been in discussions on whether we should have our educators capable of protecting themselves along with their students.
Good.
We have protocols in place for lockdown and what our teachers are supposed to do when we're in a position where we have to lock down the campus. We've got procedures in place, but there is nobody in our school district that I am aware of that carries any firearms for personal protection. And I have to back up a little bit. Currently, administratively, I don't believe that we're allowed to let our educators have a handgun, whether they have concealed or not.
I don't think there's anything that prohibits it, Tracy, because this was a big change when the legislature passed 554 and said all these districts can prohibit it. That means that under the law, I mean, I've carried a gun to schools before when I give a speech, and it's concealed. I have my permit. I'm doing it legally. Now it's going to depend on the school district. Then I won't go on those campuses. But I don't think there's anything in the law that prohibits you from doing it. So my question to you would be, would your kids be safer if some of the teachers had a pistol?
I absolutely agree with that.
Do you agree with it enough that you'd take it to the board and say, let's pass a policy rather than going along with 554, this law they passed earlier this year? Let's go the other direction. Let's authorize it. And you can write a set of rules. I mean, you can say, you know, that the teacher should carry it concealed, should have it on their person at all times, should not take it off and leave it in a desk drawer, that they should let the principal or maybe the superintendent know. And that having done that, maybe you want to even have them have a chat with the local PD about taking some time at the range or some instruction from the local police department. If you did that, and there were some teachers on that campus who had a pistol, and if you even made that known, said there's a sign in front of the school, this is true in some parts of Texas and Missouri, there's a sign that says if you come to this school to do harm, some of our staff members are armed. And I think that alone provides a deterrent value. If you agree, would you propose it to your school board?
Oh, we're in talks about it. We're getting ready to have a work session right now on this particular issue. But let's look at it a little bit further. The idea that you would post no or gun-free zone, all that is advertising.
No. You got me wrong, Tracy. I didn't say post gun-free zone. Put a sign out front that says some of our staff members are armed and you don't know who they are. If you come here to do harm to our kids, you'll be met with force.
I'm completely fine with that, Lars, if our school district was able to put that policy in place.
How many people on the board?
It's a five-member board.
Do you think you can get three votes?
Well, we're going to find out here pretty soon on the current policy whether to approve it and adopt it or not. Then we're going to have to look at the greater issue and determine what it is that we're going to do to make sure that our kids and our staff are safe.
Well, one of the first ways might be to say we are not a gun-free zone. And you could say you could just put a sign out front that says we are not a gun-free zone. You know, take that into account if you come here for any other reason. And would you let me know what the board decides?
Lars, I could call back.
I'd be glad to have you let me know because I'd be interested to see if anybody has the guts to actually do it. I think it's sensible. I think what Portland has done is crazy. And you've got the Lars Larson Show. Lars here with a question for you. Why is it that some people are distressed out about the future as you'd think they would be? The answer? They're probably among the millions of Americans who prepared themselves with emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. If the worst ever happens, literally millions of American families are already protected from dealing with those empty store shelves. Is yours? Mine is. If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com right now and grab some emergency food kits, at least one for every member of your family. These kits give you a wide variety of delicious meals that average over 2,000 calories per day. That's what you need. Everything stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. Order your kits right now by going to MyPatriotSupply.com. Your order ships fast and arrives discreetly in unmarked boxes. Listen, this is something you need to jump on now before the next news headline stuns the world. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com.